was ready for that good old western flick. And all at once, an angel slipped down next to me. So I had to think of something quick. What shall I do? So that got shot up the town. And sure enough, she was in my arms as they brought that curtain down. Oh, I
met my baby at the
baby gotcha.
Uhuru, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we came out of the box today with the music of The Deal, and The Deal at one time featured L.A. and Babyface, and they were managed by Don Taylor, the man who used to manage Bob Marley and the Wailers, and Little Anthony and the Imperials, and a controversial guy, but made a hell of a contribution to the music business. And The Deal did a song called Shoot 'Em Up Movies. And today's show is about, really about movies. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. And first of all, I would like to thank two people that I thank every week. I would like to thank Chairman Omali Ishatella, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party and the African People's Socialist International. And I would like to thank Archie Shepp. And Chairman O'Malley Ishitella was the person who made it possible for me to have a show on diasporic music. And Archie Shepp was the man who gave me the concept of diasporic music, music made in the West, but not of the West. And Archie Shepp is the man who inspired me to do diasporic music. And Chairman O'Malley Ishitella always reminds me that while we are of Africa, we are not in Africa. And we have to struggle wherever we are for ourselves and for Africa, or maybe I should say for Africa and the world. If I'm in Toronto, I have to struggle in Toronto for African and world liberation. Now, we have a very exciting show for you today. We're going to be speaking with Cameron Bailey, the artistic director of the Toronto International Film Festival, and this is the 41st version of the Toronto International Film Festival, and we'll be speaking to Cameron Bailey. He has some, there are some great films coming in this film festival this year. We're also going to be speaking with Larry Thomas, a writer, radio announcer, lecturer, based in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And he is the author of a great book, The Lady Who Shot Lee Morgan. And there's a film in the Toronto Film Festival called I Called Him Morgan. And we're going to be speaking to Larry Thomas about his book and about the film. And we're going to continue. We're going to be playing some music from Lee Morgan. We're going to listen to a song called The Lee Morgan Story by Ben Williams and John Robinson. And then we're going to hear Doug and Jean Karn do a piece called Search for the New Land. And this was a song that was composed by Lee Morgan, and lyrics were put to it by Doug Karn. And Jean Karn sings the lyrics. Doug Karn, I'm not on my case. Doug Karn became a Muslim many years, and I normally always try to if someone has taken a different name and dropped their Western or their slave name, I usually try to I'll find it during this break. But we're going to listen to Lee Morgan, The Lee Morgan Story by Ben Williams and John Robinson, and then we're going to hear from Doug Karn and Jean Karn, and they're going to be playing Lee Morgan's Search for the New Land.
Candy, City Lights, The Cooker, The Lee Morgan Story, Expobedient, Leeway, Take 12, The Lee Morgan Story, Sidewinder, Search for the New Land, Tomcat, The Lee Morgan Story, Cornbread, The Gigolo, Infinity, The Lee Morgan Story, 7/10/1938, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, birth the prodigy, a brilliant musician in the making, Pops played organ at the church every weekend. At an early age, he collected records, grew well versed, who was playing the best with horns and drums, using arms and lungs to take the world by storm and build a legacy, son. Southern roots, though he was born in the Northeast, his parents left the South on a mission to make ends meet. He lived with passion, his heart pumped music. His father was his first true inspiration to do it. Each day revealed the true essence natural. Study cats like Clifford Brown and Fats Navarro. Always wondering would the sun come out tomorrow to end the ghetto pain and sorrow also shallow. Dizzy Gillespie, Clifford Brown, Blue Note, The Lee Morgan Story, Hank Mobley, John Coltrane, Art Blakey, The Lee Morgan Story, Wayne Shorter, Benny Golson, Bobby Timmons, The Lee Morgan Story, Avant-Garde, 1960s, Joe Henderson, The Lee Morgan Story. His first teenage love was a trumpet. His sister got it for him because she knew that he wanted it. I doubt she knew what all would become of it. He studied it at the School of the Arts, not knowing he would rule from the start. His teacher was a chain-smoking local who mastered the horn, y'all. He was no joke, yo. He used to cut out of school, him and his mans, just to break early and go to the jams. You know, network and build. Humble cat just showing his skill. Met Clifford Brown and Dizzy, and he knew it was real. No voice, grace, notes, and light tone quality. methodically, shaped the longest line so ill melodically. So much hard work graduated at last. Same month with the ground, died in a car crash. So sad it crushed them. Life goes on. Huge tragedy would thrust them. A star is born. Infinity, the rump roller. Charisma, the Lee Morgan story. Delightfully, the Raja, Sonic Boom, the Lee Morgan story. The Sixth Sense, the Procrastinator. Karamba, the Lee Morgan story. Sextet, Lighthouse, Tao Wu, the Lee Morgan story. At the age of 18, he joined the Art Blakey Messenger team. The next level of things, living his dreams. A few months later, he was hired by Disney, playing big band gigs, only to further his biz. The experience outweighed the money so much he failed to attend the most prestigious school in the country. He shot junk in his veins, started to slip. His friend the family worried, was this gonna be it? No, soon arise again from the underground with a hard bop, jazz type, soulful sound. Sidewinder, first original composition, and most successful at the time in terms of chart positioning. His work ethic was massive, sideman sessions go on for days like discography lessons. Like so many, his downfall was narcotic, and soon to be his fate if he couldn't learn to stop it. It was a gun that ended his life at a gig in New York City by his so-called wife. 33 years young, so full of greatness. The Lee Morgan story, read about it in the papers. Study the streets, no filter. Dipping, caddy for daddy. The Lee Morgan story. Freedom writer, roots and herbs. The witch doctor, the Lee Morgan story. Indestructible, soul finger. Blue train, the Lee Morgan story. Helen Moore, slugs. Legacy, the Lee Morgan story.
Some land, I hope for the day that you understand.
Power to the people, power to all the people. We must use our power to make a new land. As we are
Some land. I hope for the day that you understand. We must have us some land. I hope for the day that you understand. Thank you. Understand. We must have us some land. Hope for the day that you understand.
Power to the people, power to all the people. We must use our power to make a new land.
Nanga Def, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond. Nanga Def is Wolof, and it's a language that is spoken in Senegal, the Gambia, and Mauritania, as well as wherever Wolof people and people that speak Wolof are. And we heard from Doug and Jean Karn. And Jean Karn is still, well, both of them are still around. They were married at one time. They're no longer romantically linked. They are linked by marriage, and they have children. And Jean Karn is a woman that can speak many languages, including, believe it or not, Russian. And Doug Karn is a Muslim now, and his name is Al Rahman. And we are getting ready to play a song about John William Coltrane. Now, there is a film in the Toronto International Film Festival about John Coltrane. And John William Coltrane was one of the greatest saxophonists that ever lived. And Jane Cortez did a song about him called "How Long Has Train Been Gone?" And she did that in the 70s. And we're going to listen to Sister Jane Cortez, and she's going to do "How Long Has Train Been Gone?"
Tell me about the good things. You clapping and laughing. Will you remember or will you forget? Forget about the good things like blues and jazz being black. Yeah, black music all about you. and the musicians who write and play about you. A black brother groaning, a black sister moaning, and beautiful, beautiful black children, ragged, underfed, laughing, not knowing. Will you remember their names? Or do they have no names, no lives, only products to be used when you want to dance and cry? You taking, they giving, you living, they creating, starving, dying, trying to make a better tomorrow, giving you and your children a history. But what do you care about history, black history, and John Coltrane? No, all you want to do is pat your foot, sip a drink, and pretend with your head bobbing up and down. What do you care about acoustics, bad microphones, or out-of-tune pianos and noise? You, the club owners and disc jockeys, made a deal, didn't you? A deal about black music, and you really don't give a sh long as you take. There was a time when stations played all black music, from Charlie Parker to Johnny Ace, on show after show. But what happened? I'll tell you what happened. They divided black music, doubled the money, and left us split again, is what happened. John Coltrane's dead, and some of you have yet to hear him play. How long? How long has that train been gone? And how many more trains will go before you understand your life? John Coltrane, who had the whole of life wrapped up in B flat. John Coltrane, like Malcolm, true image of black masculinity. Now tell me about the good things. I'm telling you about John Coltrane. A name that should ring throughout the projects, mothers. Mothers with sons who need John Coltrane. Need the warm arm of his music like words from a father. Words of comfort, words of Africa, words of welcome. How long has that train been gone? John palpitating love notes in a lost found nation within a nation. His music resounding discovery, signed always John Coltrane. Rip those dead white people off your walls, black people. Black people whose walls should be a hall. A black hall of fame so our children will know. Will know and be proud. Proud to say, I'm from Parker City. Coltrane City, Ornette City, Pharaoh City, living on Holiday Street next to James Brown Park in the state of Malcolm. How long will it take for you to understand that train's been gone? Riding in a portable radio next to your son, who's lonely, who walks, walks, walks into nothing. No city, no state, no home, no nothing. How long have black people been gone?
Ni hao, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we can speak two or three words in Mandarin. And joining us on the line, I'm on the line with Melinda Francis, and we're getting ready to interview Cameron Bailey, the artistic director of the Toronto International Film Festival, and this is the 41st Toronto International Film Festival. And first of all, how are you doing, Mr. Bailey?
I'm very well. How are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful. I'm going to let Melinda ask you the first question.
Okay.
Cameron, the festival's ready to start this week Thursday. So maybe talk a little bit of, you know, what's opening up the festival and what's, you know, upcoming for this year's festival.
Sure. That's right. The festival starts Thursday, September 8th here in Toronto. We're opening with The Magnificent Seven, the new film from Antoine Fuqua, with Denzel Washington and Chris Pratt and Ethan Hawke and Lee Byung-hun, this terrific Korean actor. And that's kind of a remake or reinvention of the classic Western from the 1960s, but updated for 2016. And actually, I think also much more reflective of what the old West in America was actually like. So you've got characters who are Mexican, who are indigenous, who are Asian, who are African American, and you know, we couldn't be happier to open the festival with a film like this. On opening night, we're also kicking off our spotlight on films from Lagos, Nigeria, and the opening of that section is going to be a film called The Wedding Party by Kemi Atadiba and produced by Mo Abadu, who's kind of a legend in the Nollywood film industry. So we're going to have a whole group of people in town for that as well, and that'll kick off the City to City Lagos spotlight.
Antoine Fuqua, is he actually related to Harvey Fuqua, who discovered Marvin Gaye, and there's another Fuqua, I think he sang with the Ink Spots or something like that. I've heard that, but I imagine you can answer that question.
I actually don't know if he's related, but now I need to ask him.
Yeah, I think he is. I just, I believe he is. Harvey Fuqua is, of course, sang with the, Harvey Fuqua discovered Marvin Gaye, and he's a legend in his own time, you know, Harvey and the Moon Glows and so on and so forth. But I guess the, could you talk about the blacklist? You have many, many films, black or African films. Could you talk about some of them?
Yeah. You know, we have for many years tried our best to find the best films from around the African diaspora every year for the festival. You'll remember back in the day, over 20 years ago now, we had a program that we started called Planet Africa. And that ran for 10 years in the 90s and the early 2000s. This year, we've got, I'd say, probably the biggest and deepest lineup of films from the African diaspora that we've had since the days of Planet Africa. And that includes the 8 films we have from Nigeria. It includes our opening night film, Magnificent Seven. It includes gala films like A United Kingdom, the new film from Ama Asante with David Oyelowo. The new Mira Nair film, Queen of Katwe, which was shot in Uganda and stars Lupita Nyong'o and David Oyelowo again. It includes new films from Mahamat Saleh Haroun from Chad. He's got a documentary called Hussein Habre, The Chadian Tragedy. We have another documentary from the great Raoul Peck called I Am Not Your Negro, which is all about James Baldwin. We have a film from South Africa's Akin Omotoso called Vaya. We've got some debut features from Kenya, a film called Kati Kati, from Niger, a film called The Wedding Ring, from Senegal, a film called Lulu. We have Brotherhood from Noel Clark in the UK. We, of course, have Moonlight, which is a film from Barry Jenkins, which just premiered a couple of days ago at the Telluride Film Festival to rave reviews. It's been called a masterpiece in IndieWire. So it's a big list, and a lot of films that if you are interested in films from the African diaspora and the African experience around the world, I think this is the place you're going to want to be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Melinda, you have the next question.
Yeah, I'm just interested in how the festival, because you said it's a city to Lagos, what that process is like and how that kind of gets chosen.
Sure. So City to City is a section we've been running for 8 years now. And we've gone all over the world, everywhere from Seoul, South Korea, to Buenos Aires, to Athens, to Mumbai, to Istanbul. And this year, you know, I chose Lagos. We're always looking for cities where there's, you know, a good amount of interesting production that's not widely seen. So we're looking for cities where the kind of movies we're going to invite are not ones that are readily accessible in commercial movie theaters here in North America. And then I'm also looking for a particular moment in a city's film production. I'm looking for moments of change or flux where something new is happening. And, you know, many people will know of the power, the cultural power of Nollywood, which has, been thriving for about 20 years now. And those films, the Nollywood movies, are seen all over the world. You know, you go to people's homes in Toronto or New York or Houston or London or Kingston or wherever, and you'll find Nollywood movies. So I wanted to tap some of that creative energy, but also what was happening with a new generation of filmmakers in Lagos who are not doing just the commercial Nollywood movies, but are also trying to make more independent style movies. I compare it to, you know, when Spike Lee came along in 1986 with She's Gotta Have It, and he was reacting against, you know, Hollywood commercial movies at the time, and there was a real kind of freshness to what he was putting up on screen. And I think some of what you see in the city Lagos spotlight this year will also feel like that. It'll feel, you know, that we have some movies that I think are, you know, straight up commercial Nollywood entertainment, and they're very good films like The Wedding Party that we're opening the section with, like Okafor's Law by Amoni Aboli. She's one of the most amazing artists in Nollywood right now. But we also have movies like Green, White, Green by Abba Makama or Oko Ashewo by Daniel Oriahi. And these, I think, reflect more of an indie spirit. And, you know, I compare those more to, you know, Spike Lee in the early years or John Sayles or Melvin Van Peebles in terms of doing something that has a more personal stamp to it. So the idea was to try to put together 8 films that show the range of what's going on right now in Nigeria and also points a little bit to the future. I happen to believe that, you know, films from Nigeria will take a bigger and bigger place in terms of the international film industry. I think you're going to see Hollywood flying off to Lagos to try to tap into the talent there. I think you're going to see some of these films getting even wider distribution. There's already a pretty big selection of Nollywood movies on Netflix right now, and that's new, and that's thanks to a sister named Funa Maduka, who works at Netflix, who's of Nigerian origin and believes that these movies should be seen by a wider audience. So I think we're going to see more of that, and that's why I wanted to turn the spotlight on to Lagos this year.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. I'm with Melinda Francis. We're speaking with Cameron Bailey, the artistic director of the Toronto International Film Festival. Now, the hot item, I guess one of the hottest items in almost as hot as is the Kaepernick situation is the Nate Parker situation, where Nate Parker has a film out called about Nat Turner. Nat Turner was a freedom fighter who actually, I guess his slogan was "Strike by Night and Spare None," and this guy Nate Parker was being hailed as, you know, the next great thing, and all of a sudden it came out that he had been accused of raping a Euro-American woman in, I think, 1999. She passed away, or I think she committed suicide in 2012. Mm-hmm. But and many people have dropped in, but you guys have decided to show the film. Could you talk about that controversy?
We saw Birth of a Nation months ago now, and this was a film that had been invited to premiere at the Sundance Film Festival, and it premiered there to incredible success. It really was, I'd say, the talk of the Sundance Film Festival this year. Everybody was raving about how emotionally powerful it was and how timely it was, how it told a story. You know, it was from a long time ago in terms of the Nat Turner Rebellion, but but really spoke to this particular moment when there's been such attention paid to how rare it is to see African-American stories take a central place in Hollywood cinema. Film did very well there. It won the top awards, both from the audience and from the jury. And then it was also the biggest sale. It was bought for distribution by Fox Searchlight out of the Sundance Film Festival. I wasn't at Sundance this year, so I didn't get a chance to see it there, but I was, of course, reading about it. We saw it a little while after that, and I was incredibly moved by it. I think it tells a powerful story, the sort of story that I don't think is seen often enough. American cinema is still the most dominant pop cultural force around the world, and yet it so rarely turns its attention to the story of Atlantic slavery, which, of course, is one of the founding stories of the United States of America. So I was glad to see this film. You know, some people will say sometimes, you know, we see so many slave movies. I don't think we've begun to see nearly enough slave movies. I think that history, in the same way that the history of the American West, you know, is seen so often in movies. There's a whole genre that's just about that. You know, the history of Atlantic slavery and American slavery, I think there are very powerful stories there, including the stories of resistance and rebellion. So I was
excuse me, Cameron, I don't want to cut you, but I remember seeing films about, you know, slave rebellions and slavery, but they're dealing with rebellions in Guadeloupe and Cuba. So I mean, I just wanted to second what you're saying.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. We have seen that in terms of, you know, other parts of the Americas, of the Caribbean, Central America, South America. I think we see more of that than we have in terms of American slavery. So I was very glad to see the film, very moved emotionally by it. I think, you know, it tells the story of the rebellion with incredible power. And so then we definitely wanted to show it. We began to hear about, you know, the story and the accusations against the director when everybody else did, when this media story broke of just, I think, a couple of weeks ago now. And you know, it's distressing. It's painful to read that and to be aware of what happened, no matter what perspective you might take on it. There, you know, there's no good side to this. It was a terrible thing that happened. We wanted to keep our focus on the film because we do feel that the film is an important film, and we're a film festival. So really the only thing we can do, I think, is to try to select the films that we think say something important to our audience, show them something significant, and films that we believe in, both in terms of their content and their form. I think we all know that there is often a disconnect between the artist and the art. I think as much as we possibly can, we have to try to assess them separately. I do believe that, you know, this conversation that has come up has been an important one. And for me, what was most instructive was to read the interview that Nate Parker did with Ebony magazine, where he talked about what he's learned from all of this and how he has been turning particularly to African-American women who are close to him, including some women who worked on the film, to try to better understand their perspective and their own stories, because I think he's admitted himself that he wasn't paying enough attention to that early on when this first came out. And so I think, you know, if there's anything good that's come out of this recently, it has been, you know, someone who has a prominent place and a voice in American society is learning more about the issue of violence against women. And hopefully he can begin to communicate that and offer space, I think, to the women whose voices also need to be heard. So I think that is something that needs to happen. At the same time, I do still think that the film should be seen, and people will make their own choices about whether they want to see it, and I think that's also totally fair. We made the choice that we did want to show the film based on our initial reaction to it when we saw it months ago.
You're listening to Diasporic Music. Melinda, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just wanted to sort of follow up with that. I don't know if people have also, like, read you know, Gabrielle Union's, you know, op-ed in For Harriet, which was really good. And her reaction and basically her stressing the importance of the film. But at the same time, the importance of like actually discussing that, discussing these issues as a community. So, and I'm on the same point where like, I don't think we've explored, you know, that period enough. And I hope, this is a beginning that we'll see more films, exploring the period.
And yeah, I completely agree. And I would say, you know, if anybody hasn't read Gabrielle Union's piece, I would highly recommend that as well. Roxane Gay's also done some very good writing on this. All of this, I think, is useful because I think, you know, the issue of violence against women and the issue of how African Americans have experienced life in the United States over the last few hundred years, both of those things I think deserve to be talked about more and understood on a deeper level. I don't think we have to choose one or the other. For me, this is not a question of, you know, are you for or against the film, for or against Nate Parker. It's a question of trying to understand how all of this is a part of a number of conversations that I think need to all go deeper. So I hope that people can use this as that opportunity. Whether or not they decide to see the film, I think that's every person's individual choice.
I guess, thank you for that. Last thing I wanted to deal with was, you know, could you talk about some of the film festivals that are taking place around the world in general and the African and Asian film festivals that are taking place around the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, people who are in the film industry may know, but it might not be widely known that there are thousands of film festivals around the world. Every day of every year, there are many different festivals happening, and many of them are focused on particular kinds of cinema, and they can be great opportunities to really take a deep dive into films from a certain place or a certain kind of filmmaking. This year, I was at the Durban Film Festival in South Africa, which has a focus on African cinema. And so it's a gathering of people who are interested in African cinema. In terms of the continent, there are other very important African film festivals happening in Zanzibar, Tanzania, in Nigeria, in Rwanda, and most importantly, I think, in Burkina Faso, a festival called FESPACO. There are many in Asia as well, some of the key ones being the one in Busan, South Korea. There are festivals in Hong Kong and Beijing and Tokyo and many other places, a new one in Macau starting up this year. You know, whenever I get the opportunity, I like to go to these festivals because you get a kind of a closer contact with both the filmmaking and the people who make the movies than you would at a big general festival like ours, because, you know, when you go to Zanzibar, you go to Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso, everybody there is all about African cinema. And so you can have, you know, more conversations, you get to see a wide range of films, and you get to kind of fully dive in. And I first went to FESPACO in 1991, and it really opened my eyes. And I met people there that I'm still in touch with, and I was able to just get a sense of the depth and the richness of African cinema that I don't think you get quite in the same way. And to be able to watch African films with an African audience, outdoors, for instance, in a place like Ouagadougou, is something that I will always treasure and always remember.
I forgot that the Caribbean and South America, like Brazil,
yes.
The Caribbean and Brazil. Since we had the Olympics in Brazil, Brazil is a film country. Could you talk about, you know, South America and the Caribbean in terms of the festivals that you go into there?
Sure. Brazil is a major film country that produces a lot of films every year. They have, of course, some important film festivals there. Some of their leading talent have become international, people like Sonia Braga. We actually have an onstage conversation with Sonia Braga at our festival this year. And in terms of the Caribbean, you know, I'm glad to see that the filmmakers in the different countries in the Caribbean are pushing their work out around the world more. We have a film called Aïti Mon Amour, which is from Haiti. Haitian-American filmmaker named Getty Fenin has made that, and that's going to be at our festival. We have a film that Nick Pannon, African-American, but with a deep interest in Jamaica, went down to Jamaica and shot a film called King of the Dance Hall, which co-stars Busta Rhymes. I think people will know that Busta Rhymes is of Jamaican origin himself. He plays a full-on Jamaican in the movie, and he's terrific in it. And it's all about dancehall music and dancing. And so, you know, for us, bringing these films from their home region to an audience here in Toronto that's already engaged. I mean, there's a lot of people here who are from the Caribbean who know that culture, know the music. They'll want to see films like King of the Dance Hall, big Haitian community in Canada and Montreal and also in New York, who I'm hoping will, some of whom will be able to be here for Aïti Mon Amour as well. So, you know, there are movies being made, you know, all over the world, obviously, but especially in regions where we don't see movies from. And I think festivals, whether it's ours or other festivals, that's really, you know, your main opportunity. The other thing I would say is that there's a woman named Frances Ann Solomon who runs an event called Caribbean Tales, which happens at the same time as our festival every year. So she's also bringing in a whole lot of other films and filmmakers from the Caribbean, and they'll be in Toronto at the same time as our festival's running next week. So we're glad to see that, too.
I'll let Linda can ask the last question.
What is something that you were pleasantly surprised that people, that you feel that people should see, like a surprise kind of film? Yeah.
Man, there are so many. I'm gonna say Gina the Joneses, which is a film by Stella Maggie, who's an African-Canadian. And the surprise here for me was that this is a first feature by a woman who grew up in Toronto but made the first feature mostly in the U.S., premiered at the South by Southwest Festival, did very well there. And we found the film essentially through, you know, by crossing the border and seeing its success in the U.S., but it turns out she's from right here in Toronto. So I'm thrilled to see that. I know she's already got a lot of success south of the border. I believe she's been signed by one of the big agencies in L.A., and she's on her way to a big career. But, you know, Toronto is the place that produced her, and I do think there's a new generation. I would put her alongside some of the great, you know, young musicians who are coming out of Toronto, often out of the suburbs of Toronto, who are bypassing the usual channels and are finding ways to tell their own stories and get it out into the world, and are thinking well beyond Toronto, well beyond Canada, and thinking of themselves as global artists. And it's great to see that with Stella Maggie as well.
Is there anything else you would like to add, sir?
I'm going to leave it there. I mean, I thank you for the opportunity. Oh, I'm just going to say two more things. Raoul Peck's I Am Not Your Negro, do not miss that movie. And we've got two great music documentaries as well, one on John Coltrane called Chasing Train and one called I Called Him Morgan. And if you're a jazz fan, you'd want to see both of those.
Yeah, I signed an agreement when I saw the preview, so I can't talk about the Lee Morgan film. The only thing I can say is that it's that you should see it.
Okay.
And the Haitian filmmaker is going to be on our show next.
Oh, great.
And also Larry Thomas is going to be on our show last. The guy who wrote the book, The Lady Who Shot Lee Morgan.
Okay, so you got this covered then.
Well, you know, we learn from you. We try to do our job.
So I am so thankful to you, first of all, for your interest, for helping to get the word out about these films. We hope that people will, you know, just take whatever time they can and see as much of it as they can while these films are available.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Thank you both.
All right. And we have been speaking with Cameron Bailey. And what's coming up next on Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, Melinda?
Well, we're going to be speaking with Getty Phelan, who is a director of one of the films that we'll be screening at Toronto International Film Festival called Aïti Manoir, and we'll be back with her.
All right, so let's take a break and come back.
Candy, City Lights, The Cooker, The Lee Morgan Story, Expobedient, Leeway, Take 12, The Lee Morgan Story, Sidewinder, Search for the New Land, Tomcat, The Lee Morgan Story, Cornbread, The Gigolo, Infinity, The Lee Morgan Story, 7/10/1938, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, birth the prodigy. A brilliant musician in the making, Pops played organ at the church every weekend. At an early age, he collected records, grew well-versed on who was playing the best with horns and drums, using arms and lungs to take the world by storm and build a legacy, son. Southern roots, though he was born in the Northeast, his parents left the South on a mission to make ends meet. He lived with passion, his heart pumped music. His father was his first true inspiration to do it. Each day revealed the true essence natural. Study cats like Clifford Brown and Fats Navarro. Always wondering would the sun come out tomorrow to end the ghetto pain and sorrow also shallow. Dizzy Gillespie, Clifford Brown, Blue Note, The Lee Morgan Story, Hank Mobley, John Coltrane, Art Blakey, The Lee Morgan Story, Wayne Shorter, Benny Golson, Bobby Timmons, The Lee Morgan Story, Avant-Garde, 1960s, Joe Henderson, The Lee Morgan Story. First teenage love was a trumpet. His sister got it for him because she knew that he wanted it. I doubt she knew what all would become of it. He studied it at the School of the Arts, not knowing he would rule from the start. His teacher was a chain-smoking local who mastered the horn, y'all. He was no joke, yo. He used to cut out of school. Him and his man's just to break early and go to the jams. You know, network and build. Humble cat just showing his skill. Met Clifford Brown and Dizzy and he knew it was real. No for his grace notes and light tone quality. Methodically shaped the longest line so ill melodically. So much heart. Hard work graduated at last. Same month Clifford Brown died in a car crash. So static crushed him. Life goes on. Huge tragedy with thrust of a star is born. Infinity, the rump roller. Charisma, the Lee Morgan story. Delightfully, the Raja. Sonic Boom, the Lee Morgan story. The Sixth Sense, the procrastinator. Karamba, the Lee Morgan story. Sextet, Lighthouse, Taboo, the Lee Morgan story. At the age of 18, he joined the Art Blakey Messenger team. The next level of things, living his dreams. A few months later, he was hired by Disney, playing big band games, only to further his biz. The experience outweighed the money. So
you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. And I'm going to participate in this interview, but I'm going to turn it over to Melinda Francis right now. And I'll let Melinda go for it.
So this is Melinda Francis, co-host of Diasporic Music. And on the line we have Getty Phelan, a filmmaker, a Haitian-American filmmaker who has a film called Aïti Manoumour, which will be have its international premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival. And she is a filmmaker, and full disclosure, she's one of my friends, and I met her about 4 years ago, and so I'm really super excited to introduce the film to the audience. So I'm going to turn it over to Getty, maybe talk a little bit about the film, Aïti Manoumour.
Okay, hi. Thank you, Melinda, for having me on the show. I'm very excited. First of all, I'm extremely honored that this film is part of the Toronto Film Festival. I'm also honored to be in a very wonderful selection with filmmakers that I admire. So I feel so blessed. Aïti Manoumour is a film that was born on the heels of the Haiti earthquake in 2010. And it took me a while because I needed time to really mourn the loss of so many of my compatriots. So started filming in 2014, 4 years later, and went back to Haiti in January 2015 and did the second part of the film. edited the film in Haiti as well, and Melinda, I believe you did a little bit of filming for me as well on this film, and finished just recently in March, basically. And so the film really speaks about healing after the disaster without really showing the disaster. It's three stories in one. It's a coming-of-age story of a young teenager who is grieving the loss of his father, who one day goes for a swim and discovers he has special powers. And so, of course, with special powers comes responsibility. And the second story is a love story between an old fisherman and his wife, who has a sickness, who's ill, whom they believe that the cure is in the sea. And the third story is the story of a writer and his muse, who is part muse, part character of the novel that the writer is writing. And she gets tired of him not completing the story and decides to leave and go live her own life. So that's basically Haiti Mon Amour.
This is Norman. Yeah. Go ahead, Melinda. I'll cut you off.
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Hi, Norman. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I wanted to ask you a question about Haitian filmmakers. I have been blessed to have met Raoul Peck, and he has a film in the Toronto Film Festival about James Baldwin. Cameron Bailey mentioned that film. But could you talk about the whole question of how you got into, talk about some of the films that Raoul has done and how you got into, and did he influence you and did how you got into making films?
I got into making films by necessity. Simply, I just felt like there weren't enough films that were being made by people like me and about people like me, people of color, people from developing countries, to tell our own stories. There are a lot of people who are telling our stories for us. And so it's out of necessity. Also, I fell in love with cinema when I was little in Haiti, and for me it was always a place to escape to. In my head as well, I grew up partly in the dictatorship, in the Duvalier dictatorship, so cinema had become my own little sanctuary, and it's a place where after I would see films that I would sort of like reinvent stories with Haitian characters, basically. And so I've always loved cinema, never thought that I could make films simply because I lacked role models growing up of people like me making cinema. And so when I moved to France in the early 90s, I decided to be bold and to just go ahead and start making films. I love the cinema of Raoul Peck, and he has not had any specific influence on me in terms of the kind of cinema that I make. I love his sensibility, and it definitely resonates with me. But he has been instrumental in me actually just going out there and going rogue and making my films. He basically gave me a good swift kick in the butt in 2005 when I was procrastinating about a story that I'd had inside of me and that I wanted to bring to life. And so he sort of gave me an assignment to go out and write the script. And so that script exists thanks to him, actually. Cinema in Haiti is not as important as soccer is, and but at the same time it's emerging. There are lots of young upcoming filmmakers luckily that are there to continue expressing the Haitian reality. And in making my film, I was able to work with a lot of young film lovers and cineasts, people who really want to make films, who were part of my journey as well in making this film. My editor is a graduate of the film school, which is a new film school that exists in Jacmel, called Cine Institute. And my director of productions was also a graduate of that school. And one of the sound folks was also a student at the audio school at the time who has graduated since then. So there's a lot of actual local Haitian talent in the film in bringing it together. But it's also a family affair because the film was shot by my husband, Hervé Cohen, who's sort of been the DP of all my work. And it stars my son, Joachim, who plays the lead, the young man in the film. And it's a whole family affair. I think it's, you know, for me, filmmaking is really about finding your tribe and creating art with them and keep finding that tribe and keep making films with them and keep bringing films out there with the same spirit.
Let me say the last thing I want to say, but on this issue, but one thing I've noticed about Haitians and Haitian filmmakers, like Raoul Peck said, he started making films in East Germany, and he left Haiti as a child and lived in the Congo. So the whole thing, one of the things that fascinates me about Haitians as a group of people and Haitian filmmakers is that you said you were in France, now you're in Oakland. So, you know, that whole international situation is just, it really fascinates me.
Yeah, I think, you know, like the political history of our country has made it that a lot of us are in the diaspora. And my parents went to America first in the 1960s and then again in the 1970s. And so it's been, you know, and so that's kind of like the story of Haitian cinema is also the story of the diaspora looking back in as well in the country. So that's why you have a lot of filmmakers who are in the diaspora, Haitian filmmakers who are in the diaspora, is because of the political history also of our country that has sent so many of us in exile. But I think also what we bring back is the journey on the outside as well. And so we're looking in the country at a place where we're inside, but at the same time that we can exteriorize ourselves and look at the country differently. And it's a different gaze on Haiti, actually, from the diaspora as what filmmakers inside of Haiti are making. There's a lot of films that are being made inside of Haiti that are very much in very popular in their style, but they're very much kind of soap opera-ish and centered around more like radio plays than anything else. And so that's like a lot of what's basically a lot of the actual inside of Haiti films that are being made. But there's so many of us also in the diaspora who are making films that I can't like even begin to like, you know, enumerate the number of Haitian filmmakers on the outside who are interested in Haiti and making films about Haitian subjects as well.
I just wanted to follow up about like, I guess the sort of like the impact of like the 2010 earthquake and basically your influence in actually going back to Haiti to make the last couple of films that you've made, and maybe talk a little bit about that.
I when the earthquake happened, I was living in Florida at the time, and I remember feeling like, geez, I wish I had gone to med school, which is what my parents wanted me to do. And I just felt like so useless as a filmmaker. And so 2 weeks later, I arrived in Haiti with a group of doctors and nurses and basically worked with setting up this mobile clinic in Jacmel. And so I put myself to use and, you know, and like translating for them and also doing and I decided to put together like this talking circle, and I had realized that there's so many people who had not talked about like the earthquake. I mean, people were injured physically, but also their souls were injured, and their psyche was also injured. And so I set up like this, you know, this talking circle where people are talking and people are crying for the very first time. And that whole mourning period of like, you know, mourning their lost ones, I didn't lose family members really. I have a very good friend of mine that I lost in the earthquake, and then friends of friends and families of friends of the family and so on, but no real direct impact. But it, for me, it felt very direct because it was just like, you know, 300,000 people, 300,000 of your compatriots are gone, like, you know, from one day to the next is devastating on many levels. But when I was there, I saw a plethora of cameras and just people just filming everything that was moving, and it was just like all this like whole disaster tourism that was going on, and it was just all about the disaster, and it wasn't about how my compatriots were mitigating this disaster and how what they were using as strength to, you know, to carry on and move on. And I felt like, okay, well, where I could be useful is actually to go and get that story of mitigating this disaster and keeping hope and rebirth from the disaster. So that's how Broken Stones came about, which is a documentary that I did about 18 months after the quake. I went back to shoot that film. So although I had gone back really like quickly after the earthquake, but did not pick up a camera, couldn't take pictures, couldn't do anything, I just really needed that time. So when making Broken Stones, which is a film that I shot entirely within the walls of the old cathedral, which was destroyed during the quake, so it was the ruins of the quake, and it was kind of like a metaphor for rebuilding, because I had heard that was the first edifice that was going to be rebuilt was the cathedral, so I wanted to talk about like rebuilding that space, but also rebuilding the soul, and so that documentary allowed me to basically show that and speak about that, of how my compatriots had navigated this disaster to move on, and the solidarity that they had in coming out of this disaster. So that was Broken Stones. But Haiti Mon Amour was born before Broken Stones. I was writing Haiti Mon Amour, like 6 months later after the earthquake, and but that takes longer because it's fiction, and so it was several stories, and I had to sort of like, you know, bring them like, you know, closer to home basically. When I did not have funding to make that film, I had to say, okay, where can I film that's not going to cost me an arm and a leg? With whom can I film? What kind of stories can I tell with the budget that I can bring together? And for me, Haiti Mon Amour, necessity as well is to say, okay, what do we do? Like, what do we salvage after disaster? And I didn't want to make another documentary because I already done the documentary with Broken Stones, but I wanted to do fiction because I wanted to create a space that allowed us to also fantasize, you know, and think and project ourselves and imagine, you know, post-earthquake and what kind of stories can come about. And so that's how Haiti Mon Amour was born, basically.
Mm-hmm. So how is basically, you said that you shot it in Haiti. How was that process in actually casting the film and, you know, finding your people, your tribe, like you explained? How was that process?
I went to a place that I knew. I went to a place in Jacmel, which is this little coastal fishing village called Cabique. It's three little fishing villages that I knew, that I had lived there with my kids and my husband back in 2003 to 2005. We spent 2 years there, and so I had created communities, you know, and I was integrated into the community. My family and I, we were integrated into the community, so we were able to go back and say, listen, we want to make this film, and everyone was very supportive of us. So I was very, that was very strategic as well, you know, to say, okay, where can I go and tell this story? So it's, I went to a place that I knew. And in terms of casting the film locally, it was kind of difficult to cast the lead because I really wanted my character to sort of like be an outsider as well. And so when I was working to cast, and I couldn't find anyone, and so I offered the part to my son, who really, for me, reminded me of the character and who sort of, like, helped infuse that character as well. So it just felt right. And so he said yes. He had never acted before in a film. And I think, you know, when you see the end product, you'll realize that he did a pretty decent job. And I'm being modest. Then basically it was easy from that moment on. Then the woman who plays the muse, is she's the only non-Haitian person in the film, and she is a Rwandan-born actress, theater and film actress, but lives in the United States today, and we've known each other forever. And when I told her about this, and she's pretty much been following my process for like forever, so she was definitely going to be a part of this this film. And the writer is a real writer. His name is James Noel. He's a poet. He's the most prolific Haitian poet alive today. And he said yes as well. The woman who plays the mom is a good friend of mine. She's an artist, and it's in her home that we shot the whole story of Orfei and his mom. And she said yes, and she's not an actress, but I cast her and did a little screen test, and it just, you know, she was perfect for the role. And then the fisherman is a real fisherman. I know him, you know, I buy fish from him, and I always liked him. I like his face. His face is very cinematic for me. And he said yes. And then the woman who plays his wife is actually the wife of another fisherman. And we casted her out of several women, and she was the best one for the role. And and it came together because people were just so supportive. I think when you're making art out of a place of like authenticity and sincerity within, I'm not, you know, that's all totally my own view on things, but I think people can feel it, and so they adhere, and they're very supportive. And also when it's done, that sincerity can be seen also through the final work, and that's what connects with people. That's what makes, you know, people stay and watch the film and connect with it and have a better understanding of that space, you know? And I always say the film is not a film about Haiti. It's an experience of Haiti, because it's the way that I feel Haiti is what's in that film more than anything else. If I were to say what the film is in a nutshell, you know, of course it's born out of grief and mourning, but the film is not just about grief and mourning. It's also about about hope and about the dead and the living, you know, and finding that space, you know, and negotiating that space together.
So you want to tell the audience when they can see the film and when it's premiering and, when they could come see the film.
The premiere is on the 10th, Saturday the 10th, and it's playing at the Scotiabank, and it's at 9:45. And I think tickets are really, going fast. And so I would suggest that people get on it right away. The second screening is on the 12th. And that's Monday the 12th at 3:45 p.m. And that's also at the Scotiabank. All the screenings are at the Scotiabank. And then there's a press and industry screening, which is in the morning at 10:45 a.m. And then the last screening is also is on the 18th, the last day of the festival at 9:30 p.m. also at the Scotiabank. And I am going to be there throughout the entire festival, and I'm going to be at the Q&As of all the films. My cast will be there in the premiere, not the entire cast, but the young man who has the lead in the film will be there, and as well as the woman who plays the muse, so Joachim Cohen and Anissa Uzeyman will be there as well, and a young woman named Simbi Duplan, who's also has a minor role in the film, but it's a nice role. And so it's gonna be festive. We wanna be there. We wanna be in conversation with the Toronto audience. So we're encouraging people to come out and support us and come and be in conversation with us and Haiti. I mean, that's what I like to say, is that the film is a film that is made for Haiti to be in conversation with the outside world as well. So what better place than the Toronto Film Festival that has such a love of, like, international films. So I am extremely, extremely honored and just over the moon.
This is Norman. We are almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, the last question I wanted to ask you, we have about 2 minutes, what other film festivals after this, are you going to take it to Ouagadougou? Are you going to take it to the Pan-African Film Festival in Los Angeles or...
Sure. There's Havana, Cuba, in December. We're getting, like, since the Toronto announcement, we've been inundated with, like, requests. So there's, like, festivals in India. There's the Stockholm Film Festival. We're waiting to hear from Tokyo. It's of course definitely doing the FESPACO. Next year, Ouagadougou for sure. Perhaps Vue d'Afrique in Montreal, which is a little bit later, early spring of next year. So I think the film's going to have a really, really great life in the festival circuit. We're hoping for it to, like, release in the United States and elsewhere, perhaps in January as we commemorate the 7th anniversary of the earthquake. But all that we'll see with our distributors and sales agent. We haven't made, like, any decisions yet in terms of, like, who's representing the film. We've got a lot of offers, and so we're in talks with a lot of people, but and so that will, you know, that's going to basically what's going to decide, you know, the life of the film in terms of, like, bringing it out to the audience and so on. But for sure, we're hoping to release it next year. And but yeah,
I'm glad to hear Cuba, definitely.
Excuse me?
See, I'm glad to hear that it's going to be, if the Cuba's interested, I'm happy to hear that. Cuba.
Yes, for sure. So we'll be confirmed on all that in the next few weeks or so. But yeah, and people should really follow us on Facebook and go like the film at IET Mon Amour. And then we have our Twitter handle, which is IET_Mon_Amour on Twitter. So please go follow us and like us and be in conversation with us and stay tuned for, like, you know, the trajectory of the film also during Toronto and after Toronto. We'll constantly be in conversation with everyone on the social network while we're in Toronto as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we just want to let the audience know that all the links will be on the show description so that they can go right to the links. Is there anything last you wanted to add, Getty?
No, I just wanted to say thank you for having me on the show, and I look forward to seeing you all in Toronto, and I really want to thank the festival for selecting the film and the whole crew, Cameron Bailey and his crew at Toronto for really selecting this film, and we're excited and ready to share it with the Toronto audience, so we hope everyone comes out and support it.
Amazing. I'm excited.
Thank you for giving us the time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good day.
And you have been listening to, we're getting ready to talk to Larry Thomas, and we're going to talk about Lee Morgan, and I don't know if he has any links to Haiti. I know he had links to Kenya, but we'll talk about that in Diasporic Music with Melinda Francis and myself. We'll continue.
Candy, City Lights, The Cooker, The Lee Morgan Story, Expobedient, Lee Way, Take 12, The Lee Morgan Story, Sidewinder, Search for the New Land, Tomcat, The Lee Morgan Story, Cornbread, The Gigolo, Infinity, The Lee Morgan Story, 7/10/1938, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, birth the prodigy, a brilliant musician in the making, pops played organ at the church every weekend. At an early age, he collected records, grew well-versed on who was playing the best with horns and drums, using arms and lungs to take the world by storm and build a legacy, son. Southern roots, though he was born in the Northeast, his parents left the South on a mission to make ends meet. He lived with passion, his heart pumped music. His father was his first true inspiration to do it. Each day revealed the true essence natural. Study cats like Clifford Brown and Fats Navarro. Always wondering would the sun come out tomorrow to end the ghetto pain and sorrow also shallow. Dizzy Gillespie, Clifford Brown, Blue Note, The Lee Morgan Story, Hank Mobley, John Coltrane, Art Blakey, The Lee Morgan Story, Wayne Shorter, Benny Golson, Bobby Timmons, The Lee Morgan Story, Avant-Garde, 1960s, Joe Henderson, The Lee Morgan Story. His first teenage love was a trumpet. His sister got it for him because she knew that he wanted it. I doubt she knew what all would become of it. He studied it at the School of the Arts, not knowing he would root for the start. His teacher was a chain-smoking local who mastered the horn, y'all. He was no joke, yo. He used to cut out of school, him and his mans just to break early and go to the jams. You know, network to build. Humble cat just showing his skill. Met Clifford Brown and Dizzy and he knew it was real. No voice, grace, no delight, tone quality. Methodically, shaped the longest line so ill melodically. So much hard work graduated at last. Same month, Clifford Brown died in a car crash. So sad it crushed him. Life goes on. Through tragedy with thrust of a star is born. Infinity, the rump roller. Charisma, the Lee Morgan story. Delightfully, the Raja, Sonic Boom, the Lee Morgan story. The Sixth Sense, the Procrastinator. Caramba, the Lee Morgan story. Sextet. Lighthouse, Tabo, The Lee Morgan Story. At the age of 18, he joined the Art Blakey Messenger team. The next level of things, living his dreams. A few months later, he was hired by Disney, playing big band gigs, only to further his biz. The experience outweighed the money so much he failed to attend the most prestigious school in the country. He shot junk in his veins, started to slip. His friend and family worried, was this gonna be it? No, soon arise again from the underground with a hard bop, jazz type, soulful sound. Sidewinder, first original composition, and most successful at the time in terms of chart positioning. His work ethic was massive, sideman sessions go on for days like discography lessons. Like so many, his downfall was narcotic, and soon to be his fate if he couldn't learn to stop it. It was a gun that ended his life at a gig in New York City by his so-called wife. 33 years young, so full of greatness. The Lee Morgan story, read about it in the papers. Study the grace, no filter. Dipping, caddy for daddy, the Lee Morgan story. Freedom writer, roots and herbs. The witch doctor, the Lee Morgan story. Indestructible, soul finger. Blue train, the Lee Morgan story. Helen Moore, slugs. Legacy, the Lee Morgan story. candy, city lights, the cooker, the Lee Morgan story, expobedient, leeway, take 12, the Lee Morgan story, sidewinder, search for the new land, tomcat, the Lee Morgan story, cornbread, the gigolo, infinity, the Lee Morgan story, 7-10-1938, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, birth the prodigy. A brilliant musician in the making, Pops played organ at the church every weekend. At an early age, he collected records, grew well-versed on who was playing the best with horns and drums, using arms and lungs to take the world by storm and build a legacy, son. Southern roots, though he was born in the Northeast, his parents left the South on a mission to make ends meet. He lived with passion, his heart pumped music, his father was his first true inspiration to do it. Each day revealed the true essence natural. Study cats like Clifford Brown and Fats Navarro. Always wonder would the sun come out tomorrow to end the ghetto pain and sorrow also shallow. Dizzy Gillespie, Clifford Brown, Blue Note, the Lee Morgan story, Hank Mobley, John Coltrane, Art Blakey, the Lee Morgan story, Wayne Shorter, Benny Golson, Bobby Timmons, the Lee Morgan story, Avant-garde, 1960s, Joe Henderson, the Lee Morgan story. His first teenage love was a trumpet. His sister got it for him because she knew that he wanted it. I doubt she knew what all would become of it. He studied it at the School of the Arts, not knowing he would root from the start. His teacher was a chain-smoking local who mastered the horn, y'all. He was no joke, yo. He used to cut out of school, him and his mans, just to break early and go to the jams. You know, network and build. Humble cats, just showing his skill. Met Clifford Brown and Dizzy, and he knew it was real. No for his grace, no for light tone quality. Methodically, shaped the longest line so ill melodically. So much hard work, graduated at last. Same month, Clifford Brown died in a car crash. So sad it crushed him. Life goes on. Huge tragedy would thrust him. A star is born. Infinity, the rump roller. Charisma, the Lee Morgan story. Delightfully, the Raja. Sonic Boom, the Lee Morgan story. The Sixth Sense, the procrastinator. Karamba, the Lee Morgan story. Sextet, Lighthouse, Tom Wolf, the Lee Morgan story. At the age of 18, he joined the Art Blakey Messenger team. The next level of things, living his dreams. A few months later, he was hired by Diz, slaying big band gigs, only to further his biz. The experience outweighed the money so much he failed to attend the most prestigious school in the country. He shot junk in his veins, starting to slip. His friend and family worried, was this gonna be it? No, soon arrives again from the underground with a hard bop, jazz type, soulful sound. Sidewinder, the first original composition, and most successful at the time in terms of chart positioning. His work ethic was masked in sideman sessions, go on for days like discography lessons. Like so many, his downfall was narcotic, and soon to be his fate if he couldn't learn to stop it. It was a gun that ended his life at a gig in New York City by his so-called wife. 33 years young, so full of greatness. The Lee Morgan story, read about it in the paper. Study the streets, no filter. Dipping, caddy for daddy. The Lee Morgan story. Freedom writer, roots and herbs. The witch doctor, the Lee Morgan story. Indestructible, soul finger. Blue train, the Lee Morgan story. Helen Moore, slugs. Legacy, the Lee Morgan story.
Uhuru, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and I'm with Melinda Francis, and Lisa Watson is on the buttons, and joining us on the line is Larry Thomas, a writer, radio announcer, lecturer, and he's based in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and he's the author of The Lady Who Shot Lee Morgan, and he's coming to the Toronto Film Festival. This has been a film festival show. And you're coming to the Toronto Film Festival the film will be screened next Sunday, but you'll be doing a book launch. Let's talk about the book launch at the different book lists.
Yeah, brother. First of all, greetings from the land of Train, Monk, Nina, and Max Roach. I'm
going to need it. And pardon me, and you forgot one, George Clinton.
Oh, yeah. And Percy Heath. Well, yeah, that's a long story.
Okay, go ahead. The long story, go ahead.
I'm going to be there on Saturday. Yeah, I'm going to do a book signing on Saturday.
At a different book list.
It's like a very nice place. It's called A Different Book List.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, I'll be there from 6 until 8, and then I'll be at the film festival that next day. I think the filming is going to be at 6. I'm not too sure about that.
It is. We'll put all of that stuff on the website.
Right. Well, I'm looking forward to it. The last time I was in Toronto was very, very cold, January 2003, and it was during the International Jazz Conference, International Jazz Education Association.
I was there, and I didn't meet you then. Yeah, I was there.
I look forward to meeting you.
All right.
I'm excited. I'm excited about coming here. I'm excited about talking about the movie. I'm excited about talking about my book. And so I'm just excited about it. It'll be the first time I'll get a chance to see the movie. I haven't seen it yet.
Well, I've seen it. I can't talk about it, but I saw it because I signed an agreement that I can't talk about it until it's out. But let me say, can you tell people, for young people, who was Lee Morgan and who was Helen Morgan?
Lee Morgan was a fantastic trumpet player. He was he actually started out very, very young at the age of 16 with the Dizzy Gillespie big band. And he was interesting because he was articulating notes and playing music that you would hear from a person maybe 3 or 4 times his age. And so he reminded me a lot of Roy Hargrove, a very young cat who started playing music very, very young, and he caught on, became very popular almost overnight. You know, he was a very, very much a part of those Blue Note sessions of the 60s, in the late 60s.
Right.
And, you know, he met Helen when he was a dopey, when he was a junkie. Helen had this house I think she was in Midtown, maybe on 53rd Street, in that area, and she was right around the corner from all the jazz clubs. And when the jazz musicians would leave their gigs, they would come by her pad, you know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and she would serve them food and everything. And that's how she met Lee. She met him one cold February night. As a matter of fact, I've written a poem based on that. And she killed him on a cold February night. So, I mean,
February 19th, 1972?
February 19th, early in the morning, yeah, early in the morning, man. 1972 is when she killed him, but she met him much earlier than that. And she resurrected his career. You know, he was a junkie, and she cleaned him up. She had a habit of taking in people who were kind of down and out, you know. She cleaned him up, got him back on his feet, and then she killed him. That's how that went down. It went down like that.
And that was, to kill him, I guess, is, I mean, that's part of human history, African history. I mean, Don Drummond, the great trombone player from Jamaica, he killed his wife, and I mean, it's we're talking about domestic violence. That's part of the history of
right.
humanity, and unfortunately, I think African people we get labeled as being the most brutal people in the world. You know, from you know the narrative, if you. But I mean, I think that's. As long as there's been men and women, there has been violence against women. That's in my judgment.
Right. And it's usually a triangle. He started messing with a younger woman. She was much older than he was. She was like 12, 13 years older than he was. And as they grew and as she became older, she even said this, because I interviewed her in 1996, a month before she died. When I found out who she was a student of mine in one of my classes. And she said she loved jazz music because I've been in jazz radio since 1978. I was working at a jazz radio station, a public radio station. And I mentioned the fact that I was jazz radio host. And she said, oh, I love jazz. My husband was a jazz musician. And I said, really, what was your husband's name? And she said, Lee. And I said, well, I sure would like to interview you one day. And she said, I'll think about it. And it took her 7 years. And she finally consented to an interview. And when I interviewed her, she mentioned the fact that as the relationship became older and time, she just assumed that he looked upon her as his mother because she kept nagging him about, because he was still using drugs. She kept nagging him about using drugs and various other things. So that's when he started messing with a younger woman at that point. That's what she said. So it was Frank and Johnny kind of thing.
I want to ask you one more question, then I wanted to let the co-hosts ask you some questions. But of all of the stuff I read about Lee Morgan, it's always about he was a musical genius and he was a ladies' man. He was a very nice-looking guy,
yeah.
And women flocked to him. And he was well-dressed and blah, 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 blah. But what I don't hear people talk about is the fact that Lee Morgan was a political human being. He wrote a song called, I think, Mr. Kenyatta. I guess when everybody thought Jomo Kenyatta was the burning spear, which he was not, but that's another issue. You know, he he was an African patriot. Could you talk about his politics?
He was a black nationalist. Once I started talking to her, and she started, well, first of all, I'm a Pan-Africanist. And the course that I taught was a Western civilization course, but I go all the way back to the ancient African civilizations, and I bring it up through the Romans and the Greeks. So I think that was one of the reasons why I kind of gained confidence in her. But once I really started talking to her, she mentioned the fact, I said something about the 60s and, you know, something about the Black Power movement. And she said, oh, yes. Yeah. She said he was a black nationalist. He interrupted Dick Cavett's show. He was along with Rashawn Roland Kirk. I forget the name of the organization. Was the Black Musicians Collective or something like that?
I remember. Yeah. There's a whole book about it.
Rashawn and all of those guys would interrupt those programs during that time were live programs. They weren't recorded. So he interrupted the program, live program. And he said, well, why don't you hire more African-American musicians? Why don't you hire more jazz musicians? So he was, and if you notice, there's an album on Blue Note called, I think it's called the Lee Morgan Memorial Album. It's an anthology of his music. You notice that he's sitting there, and behind him is a shadow of the Sphinx. Also,
yeah.
he has a ring on, which is red, black, and green.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And he wore a lot of dashikis during that time. And if you notice, I've seen some shots of the movie. I won't say I haven't seen any of the movie. I've seen some shots. But if you notice, there are some shots in the movie where Helen is always, she always has an afro. Her hair is never straightened. So, yeah, he was a black nationalist. That's what she said. She said he was a
Latin. The last thing I want to ask you before I turn it over to Melinda, the bass player Jimmy Emerick wrote a song called Angela for Angela Davis, and let me leave it at that. And I think Melinda, she doesn't know that much about Lee Morgan. She probably has some questions for you.
Okay, brother, sure.
Well, my question was, I guess.
Hi, Melinda.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine.
I'm excited to see you.
Okay.
I was just wondering, I guess your relationship and like, when you were approached by this filmmaker, and what was that process like? I guess I'm a little selfish because I'm a filmmaker myself, so I was just wondering that.
I'll tell you what happened. The interview that I conducted with Mrs. Morgan ended abruptly because her grandson walked in while I was conducting the interview. And at that point, she just stopped talking about it because nobody knew about it. She didn't talk to anybody, especially her family. So I was going to come back and interview her, but I was emceeing a show, and Etta Jones was a part of the show. And she was a good friend of Helen. She said, well, you know Helen has passed. I said, no, I didn't know that. So I wasn't able to complete the interview, so I decided to write an article. I posted it on the Internet. It went from here to Thailand. It's been translated into several different languages. It's on the web. You can Google it. The lady who shot Lee Morgan. I get a invitation to look at it on the Google Docs almost every day. So that's how it got out there. Casper Collin called me from Sweden and said that he'd like to have a copy of the interview. And could he use the interview in a film that he's going to... He told me the film was going to be on Lee Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, sure. Then I got contacted by another guy from San Francisco, a filmmaker, who also wanted to do a movie, but he wanted to put a Hollywood slant on it. And I had already seen My Name is Albert Isla. So I went with Casper. And I like the way what the Swedes do, because they're very naive about, somewhat naive about race relations in America. So I like that slant. So that's how I got in touch with Casper.
Right. Oh, they're a Swedish company. That's interesting.
There's what now?
Yeah. So what was it? So basically you were writing the book while they were producing the documentary.
No, it was an article. The article came out in 2007.
Right.
And so I wrote the book after the whole thing went down. I decided to sit down and write a book. I wrote a book called The Lady Who Shot Lee Morgan, but it's just a book about my experiences with Helen Morgan, and I also include the article in the book. And there's a discography. There's also some information on the New York Times did a piece on, you know, on his death, and Rolling Stone did a piece. So it's a nice little book, you know. It's like a primer on Lee Morgan, you know, for people who don't know who Lee Morgan was.
And you're going to be signing the book when you come here, right?
Oh, no question. Yeah, no question. I've done book signings in New York, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and I always get these ladies who come out, you know, and I kept saying, well, why are these ladies coming out? It's basically about... Oh, what is it? Marriage abuse, marital abuse. They're really interested in, because a lot of people told me that Lee abused her just as much as he abused him. you know, that he would talk to her all kind of ways in public, and they would argue all the time. I guess it was near the end of their relationship. But the ladies really seemed to like this story for the abuse, the physical abuse thing. I don't know if he ever hit her, but he was definitely, according to people that I've talked to, verbally abusive toward her in public.
Well, the guy who took the gun from her was Paul West, and I think I met Paul West in 2003 at that conference. I think I met him, but I don't know if it was that time. But he is close to Randy Weston, and he's also, for whatever it's worth, he's a Caribbean brother from I think the Virgin Islands, right?
Yeah, he's from St. Croix. I met him.
St. Croix.
Through the Heath brothers. Jimmy is a good friend of mine. Jimmy said, well, you need to talk to Paul West. I said, why? He said, because Paul was sitting at the table with Helen when she shot Lee. She actually walked into the place, and he said, oh, sit down with us, Helen. And that's when she got into the argument with Lee, and they threw her outside. He threw her outside, and that's when the gun fell out and everything. She had the gun inside of her pocketbook.
That was a gun that Lee had brought her, the gun to protect herself, right?
Exactly. But Paul West is like an eyewitness. He was sitting there. As a matter of fact, when Casper got to the point that he wanted to do the movie, he actually stayed in my apartment when I was in Chapel Hill and everything. And I recommended certain people to him. I recommended Paul West. I recommended Larry Ridley. As a matter of fact, we found her son. Her son lives in Charlotte, North Carolina. We went down there and interviewed her son. So it was a fascinating experience. I had a wonderful time. You know, it was a wonderful time. He actually came down here twice filming. And he was fascinated by North Carolina. So it was a fascinating experience. I had a wonderful time working with Castor. He's a perfectionist and a very nice cat.
Sweden, I guess. Sweden is a... I was in a group called the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and the brother who painted the shrine of the Black Madonna, his name was Glanton Dowdell, and he was always into something, and he was a revolutionary brother, and he had been to prison for, as a kid, and he was a great, he painted the shrine of Black Madonna, but he had to go to Sweden. That's when he passed away in Sweden. And he was about 20 years older than all of us, but, and I know a little bit about the Swedish folks because, like, they looked after Glanton very well over there.
Have you seen the Black Power mix tape?
Yes, sir.
That's a Swedish. Right. We got along real well, and I thought I made the right move by not. Because the guy in San Francisco actually got really mad at me because I didn't go with him. I mean, and I just didn't feel right. You know, he wanted to do some kind of Hollywood thing. I guess the same thing that massacre they did with Miles is with Miles' Miles Ahead thing. I guess that's what he wanted to do. But I said I'm gonna go with Casper. So he bought the rights to the interview, and he's using the interview in the movie. He has used the interview in the movie, so. I'm happy, man. I'm happy that it all came to, because he took a very long time. It took him 7 years to put it together.
Yep. So you're bringing books. You're bringing up a thousand copies of your book, right?
not quite.
I'm just joking.
I know. I'm bringing some books here. I mean, it's been on the market for a couple of years now. You know, it's doing okay.
Let me give a plug to Edwin Wilson. He sent me your book many years ago.
Yeah, man, he's a good guy. I mean, he listened to my program every Sunday night, and I interviewed Kwame Ture, and he wanted that interview that I did of Kwame Ture. So we've had a good relationship, but I've had a very good experience with this, and you know, never in a million years. That I would have thought that it would have come into being a movie. That just didn't cross my mind. I just got this story. This story just fell in my lap. And apparently I'm the only one she told the story to. As a matter of fact, the police records, my understanding is the police records disappeared. You know.
How long did Helen Morgan stay in in prison, a couple of weeks or a couple of months?
Something like that. She got arrested in February, and I think she told me she finally raised the bail money in around May or something like that. And then she never went back.
And she got out of, she went back home to the land of all the giants like yourself and George Clinton, right? Yeah, North Carolina.
But not right away. She actually hung around New York for a minute. You know, she was in the Bronx. Then I think she was upstate in Yonkers for a minute, and then she finally decided to come back home because her mother was ill. So that's how that went down. But it just fell in my lap. And I'm a historian, so I knew the value, the significance, the historical significance of the story. So that's why I got it, you know. And she just took me into her confidence, you know. It was just one of those things, you know. But I was in New York at that time too, during the late '60s and the early '70s. So I knew that whole scene, you know. I knew where she was coming from. I think she kind of sensed that. But she was a fascinating lady. She came off as this old grandmother type, but when I started interviewing her, it was just I was like I was talking to another person, man. It really was. She came off real slick, you know. She started talking real slick and everything, New York style. I said, okay. I didn't say anything. I just let her talk, you know. I said, okay. She told me these crazy stories about Miles, and she met all these people, Billie Holiday. She talked about Donna Washington. She said, I don't think I could work for Donna Washington because she was too mean to her employees.
So she was I'm looking at her book right now, The Queen. Yeah, she was. How many times was Diana? She was married 7 times, maybe something like that.
I thought it was 9.
Well, maybe about, you're probably right.
I said 9, brother. But I'm looking forward to coming to Toronto once again. I hope the weather's not as brutal as it was last time.
It won't be. But let me say, we have been speaking with Larry Thomas. I'd like to thank Lisa Watson. I would like to thank Melinda Francis for co-hosting the show with me today. And we have 1 minute left, Larry. So if you wanted to freestyle, if you wanted to.
Does she have any more questions? One more question?
We only have 1 minute.
Okay, well, so I'm inviting everybody to come out to the book signing and to come out to the movie, too, you know. So just come on out. You know, I'm sure you'll give them more information. But I'm looking forward to being in Toronto. I'm looking forward to meeting everybody and having a good time. All right?
All right, sir. Thank you very much. We will be in touch with you.
Okay, peace.
And we will see you.
All right, bro.